Dana, why don't I start with you? The Master, of course, is the latest film from Paul Thomas Anderson, the writer-director behind such films as Boogie Nights, Magnolia, and There Will Be Blood. This one stars Philip Seymour Hoffman as a would-be guru modeled somewhat, though this is controversial, on L. Ron Hubbard, the founder, of course, of Scientology. It also stars Joaquin Phoenix as one of the very early followers of this cult. Dana, this is obviously an extraordinary film in one way or another. It's obviously an event. There Will Be Blood, I believe, was a total masterpiece and a triumph. This is his follow-up film. One's response to it cannot possibly be uncomplicated. I'm dying to know what your uncomplicated response to this movie is.
I'm still sorting out my response to it. One thing I would start off our conversation by saying is that I really recommend this movie be seen in 70 millimeter. And I don't know if you guys saw the same movie I did, because I've now seen it in 70 millimeter and or 65, I guess technically it is, the big version, and the 35 millimeter version. And it's so different. It looked and felt so completely different. So I just wanted to put out that recommendation if people can seek out a place to see it 70 millimeter style.
I was wondering about that because I saw it in 70 millimeter and felt absolutely drenched in the visuals. Like, they just looked so gorgeous that I spent half the movie thinking all other directors in the world should just go home and give up. Like, every single shot in this is just immersing me in pure visual pleasure. But then I couldn't tell whether I had just been boondoggled by the 70 millimeter of it. And actually, I'm hearkening back to a bygone era of cinema and not the technical directorial skill of Paul Thomas Anderson.
Well, I think you kind of had been boondoggled, but he chose that particular tool with which to boondoggle his audience. So I think if you can possibly avail yourself of it, you should. It doesn't seem like cheating. It's more like choosing your tools wisely.
Wait, so what did it look like in the regular 35 millimeter?
Just less information in the image. I mean, I couldn't exactly tell what wasn't there, but yeah, the colors are less crisp. I mean, it's essentially almost like the difference between HD and regular television or something. But yeah, a less immersive experience, I would say.
Okay, so it's a ravishing film, thanks in part to its cinematography and its directorial composition, but it's also a story. It's also about something. Talk to me a little bit about whether you found the film moving as a story or intriguing or however. How did you react to it as an entire experience?
I would say that the first time I saw it, I felt maybe a little bit more aesthetically dazzled, but not so emotionally involved. And it's a pretty complicated story. It's a lot of characters. It's a big palette. It's sort of an epic story, right? It begins during World War II and ends maybe midway through the 50s or so. So it covers a pretty big expanse of time. But the relationship that it centers on, which is this relationship between the guru, the master, as he's called in the film, the Philip Seymour Hoffman character, and Freddie Quill, who's the World War II veteran that Joaquin Phoenix plays, is really the emotional heart of the movie. And I think the reason that it's a little bit hard to know where you stand in relation to sort of who to identify with or who to care about in this movie is that they're both so opaque and mysterious, right? It's kind of like this clashing of wills, as was There Will Be Blood, right, between an older man and a younger man. And even more so than in There Will Be Blood, I would say, these two characters are sort of these mythic, unknowable walls that you just can't get past a certain point. And that, to me, made it hard, at least on a first viewing, to know exactly where to place yourself as a viewer. Let's listen to a clip from the movie.
You seem so familiar to me.
What do you do?
I am a writer, a doctor, a nuclear physicist, a theoretical philosopher. But above all, I am a man. Hopelessly inquisitive man, just like you.
Julia, it seems to me there's no way to encounter this movie without talking about and thinking about the performances, which are remarkable, right? I mean, there is every bit as astonishing, really, as the cinematography of the look of the film. What did you think about seeing these two really masterful American actors interacting with one another as these archetypal characters, the master and his would-be slave, in a way?
I basically thought that Joaquin Phoenix was outmatched. I think that Philip Seymour Hoffman gave an extraordinary performance, one of the best I can remember of his, as this puffed up, pompous man who has started this cult and built this community and has his own insecurities and flies off the handle. But you can also see why he's charming and how he's cultivated this group of followers. And I found the Freddie Quill character, as played by Joaquin Phoenix, to be this spastic, inscrutable bundle of tics. And I felt like for the narrative of the story, I mean, to me, the story is about what is it that makes people drawn into cults? What is it? What is the appeal of a group like this or a leader like this? And Freddie is such an inscrutable character and such an unrelatable character that I don't feel like the movie actually really helps you understand what would bring someone in.
I have to say, I really disagree with you. I thought of this as a film very much about the spiritual slave. Like, what is it about someone that draws them into the fold and allows them to eventually give themselves their own volition, their own sense of purpose and spiritual being over to someone else that endows someone like Philip Seymour Hoffman with the powers of a master? That seems to me the real mystery. The movie opens with Joaquin Phoenix and really follows him. And one of the Dana, I wonder if you agree with me, one of the more remarkable scenes in a recent American movie is the one where they finally meet, which is on a boat, and boats play a huge role, symbolic role in this movie. And it conveys to you the feeling of what it is to be a totally contextless, abandoned human being. He's suffering from war trauma. He has no social context within which to re-experience himself as a normal human being, and he's effectively drifting, and he comes across this boat that's kind of lit magically from within. It's just lambent and floating universe, and he enters that world, and you enter that world with him from his point of view.
After having, we should say, spent about 20 minutes following him through all sorts of peripatetic, horrible post-war time adventures where he can't hold down a job, he suddenly has outbursts of violence at every job and has to leave, he's on the run from some migrant workers that are trying to kill him. So essentially at that point, we've come a long way with Freddie Quill and seen how lost he is.
And then you experience what it is to go from a life with no center of gravity whatsoever to one in which a kind of family, a self-created family, coheres around one enormously powerful, charismatic human being. And all of a sudden, this thing that's accompanied all of us all our lives, the cults of the 1970s, Scientology, for which this is meant to be a kind of account of, ambiguously an account of, suddenly they make a kind of sense in a way. And I thought Phoenix really delivered a masterful method performance of a man whose body has really physically been reshaped by loneliness and war trauma and what this experience might mean to him. I thought he was the center of the movie.
That he's the center of the movie, I don't dispute. I see Julia's discomfort with the two different registers that they're performing in, and I think that was probably deliberate, but I don't think there was anything that Paul Thomas Anderson could probably have done about it. It seems to me like he gave both of those actors kind of the free rein to do what they were going to do, and Joaquin Phoenix went very far down this sort of Brando-esque road, right, of just kind of feral being.
Right. I mean, he's definitely the heart of the story, and I think that's why I found the performance a bit of a barrier to entering the world of the movie as completely as I think I could have if someone had given a slightly more subdued but equally pathos-filled performance. I mean, what did you guys make of this? This was touted in the run-up to the film as Paul Thomas Anderson's expose of Scientology, you know, is finally the movie about L. Ron Hubbard. What did you think, and what do you think viewers will think of that if they go into the movie with those expectations?
You know, especially given, if you remember in Magnolia, the Tom Cruise character in Magnolia, who was not exactly a cult leader, but who was a sort of a very scary motivational speaker, right? I thought that this movie was going to be more along those lines, that there'd be some sort of an incendiary critique of kind of brainwashing and cultism. And it's actually not terribly critical of these post-war spiritual movements, of which Scientology was one, as I thought it would be at all. In fact, there's really a lot of understanding afforded toward, you know, Philip Seymour Hoffman and his attempt to recreate some kind of a community in this post-war vacuum.
Yeah, it's a deeply sympathetic movie without an ounce of apology, right, which is an extraordinary needle to have threaded. We can all agree, right? You'd be crazy to skip this movie. People should go see it, right? This is just a, you know, to put it crudely, this is a massive three-way thumbs up from us, right?
Yes, I think people should see it. I mean, I didn't like it as much as There Will Be Blood. I felt it was a little slower. There were some barriers to entry, but it's just so beautiful. I mean, for the single shot that repeats actually three or four times in the movie of the wake of a boat, which for anyone who's ever ridden ferries or just been on boats, looking at the wake of a boat in water as it unfurls behind you is one of the most glorious things that can happen to you in your life as a human on the planet. And I've never really seen it captured on film. And they're just these long shots of wakes in the movie. Just go for the wakes. That's my review.
Agreed.
And we haven't even talked about Amy Adams, who plays Philip Seymour Hoffman's wife and this sort of steel-willed Lady Macbeth of this not Scientology cult that he's running. She is really fantastic and I think is going to be all over awards season for this role. It's in some ways an atypical Amy Adams role. I mean, she's on the surface is very much the kind of sweet, nurturing Disney girl that Amy Adams tends to get cast as. But then just underneath is this incredible ferocity and
stone cold
zealous
ice
dedication.
Bitch. Yeah, it's amazing. If you think of her compared to her Muppets character and then you picture the character from this movie, it's pretty great.
I also think we should shout out the music, which I think, as always, Paul Thomas Anderson is great at choosing music. He's great at choosing pop standards, in this case, old World War II kind of jazz standards. And for example, I absolutely love the montage early in the film when we're seeing Joaquin Phoenix settle into his post-war life not very comfortably. And on the soundtrack, we hear Ella Fitzgerald singing Get Thee Behind Me, Satan, which at that moment is so multivalent. It means that he's putting the war behind him, right? But it also has to do with sexual temptation and this woman that he has his eye on in the department store where he works. I thought that was a beautiful musical moment. The original score by Johnny Greenwood, the Radiohead guitarist who also did the There Will Be Blood score, is just astounding, very unsettling, weird, atonal, sort of keeps you permanently off balance throughout the film.